Welcome, listeners, to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm a long-standing journalist of food, health, and the environment, and the interconnection between them. The show is called Connect the Dots because we connect the dots between all of the things that affect our health, our well-being, and how that connects to what both we can do personally, what we need to do as community members, what we need to do as citizens, what we need to do as inhabitants of the global earth. And so on this show, we talk about all of the different activities, initiatives, policies, science, and everything that is part of the greater framework of our well-being and survival and that of other species here on planet Earth. And we've been on the air now for, I think it's going on 7 years, actually, at this point. Very exciting. We've had wonderful guests week after week after week, and I hope you will check the Connect the Dots archives, which you can find by Googling Connect the Dots Podbean. Many wonderful shows we've had. And today, in the tradition of having thought leaders, scientists, advocates, authors, filmmakers, journalists, I'm delighted to welcome Jonathan Latham, PhD. He is the co-founder and executive director of the Bioscience Resource Project, as well as the editor of the Independent Science News website. As you can tell, Dr. Latham is a scientist, and given our ample coverage of food and the GMO issue over many years of the show, it won't surprise my regular listeners to learn that Dr. Latham has a master's degree in crop genetics and a PhD in virology. He's held all kinds of important scientific positions and has a really intimate knowledge, as I know from our prior conversations, of what's going on behind the scenes in the world of science as we know it to be today around some of the areas of conversation and dispute. Most recently, I was delighted that he did a terrific piece, which is especially important for reasons we'll discuss on the show, which is, and the title of the piece, which appears in his publication, Independent Science News, is Why the Food Movement is Unstoppable. Very hopeful, something I know many will be excited to hear. Welcome to Connect the Dots, Jonathan Latham.
Thanks for having me, Allison.
So let's just begin. You know, recently in the United States, it's about 2 months ago now, President Obama signed the DARC Act. The DARC is a kind of an acronym for Deny Americans the Right to Know. That isn't the way it's registered at Congress, you know, where it has a bill number, which I don't recall at the moment. But in any case, it basically, you know, we had many years of a labeling movement, a movement to label GMO foods, which something like 90% of the American public wanted. So that the decision is in our hands to make the choice about what foods we want to eat and give our children and families. There are arguments, and we've covered that on Connect the Dots as well, as to whether or not there are health or safety issues. With GMO foods, with the pesticides used on them, there are questions about how these foods have been regulated and kind of the overextended influence of Monsanto on both, you know, they're being allowed by the FDA, as well as, a kind of infiltration of both government agencies and media to put out the word that, you know, they're poo-poo, they're safe, no problem. Nevertheless, people still wanted the right to know, and now through a supposed labeling law, that has become more difficult in the United States because, you know, an odd and eccentric form of symbolic labeling that no one can visually decipher and understand for themselves without interpretation by a smartphone has been, you know, substituted and put in place, and for simply saying it contains GMOs or it doesn't in words that people could read. And this has really kind of raise questions in people's minds about the future of GMO labeling, if any, in this new and less hopeful context. In the middle of that comes your article, your superb article at Independent Science News, explaining why the food movement has the stuff to endure and will endure. So can you share with our listeners, why you're optimistic at this moment in time?
Sure, I can do that. The basic reason that I explained in the article is that the food movement is kind of based on a novel philosophy. And when you take that together with the idea that the existing philosophy of our establishment is basically bankrupt, then you can understand why we need a new philosophy. You know, our existing establishment does not have an answer to climate change, for example. It doesn't have an answer to the problem of the problems of the food supply, right? To having health and safe, healthy and safe food. It doesn't have problems to the issue of, you know, what happens with the computerization and the removal of jobs. It doesn't have answers to the problems of what happens to local communities. So our establishment basically is intellectually bankrupt. And the basic problem it originates from the Enlightenment. So we have had, since the time of the Enlightenment, 1600 or so, a whole kind of our society has been organized around some ideas that have to do with the disconnection of things from other things. And mm-hmm. So the idea was that basically, René Descartes, he basically wanted to build up a philosophy based on thought, on the idea that thinking about stuff and even things like mathematics was more true than reality. And so you could have, and then because reality, you can the theory was that you can distrust reality. Maybe your eyes are deceiving you. Maybe your sight, your hearing is deceiving you, right? So they had this idea that you can build up your society from abstract reasoning. And so this is what they've been doing ever since. And our whole society is based on these ideas. But if you, when you try to apply that, for example, to biological reality, it doesn't work, right? You know, we end up poisoning each other. We end up being upset with each other. We end up being endangering each other. We end up not understanding each other. If you try, because there isn't enough, it basically can't be done, right? So they embarked on a project which couldn't be done. And now the food movement is the only intellectual alternative to that. And most people in the food movement are not intellectuals, but without necessarily realizing it, what they're essentially doing is refuting the values of the Enlightenment that we've been attempting to put in place for the last 400 years. And so this is why I'm excited about what the food movement is doing. Because it's basically
Let me just interject a question here. You know, when we hear the term enlightenment, that sort of sounds good.
Sure it does, yeah.
Yeah. It seems like, well, what could be wrong with that,
That's right. That's it. But, I mean, what could be wrong with communism, right? It's all about community. But it's basically, communism... community is not an accurate description of what communism actually turned out to be. And enlightenment is not an accurate description of what the Enlightenment philosophy turned out to be. It was given that name by the people who liked it, right? And it was because basically the elite, the wealthy aristocrats and the wealthy industrialists liked what they were hearing from people like Descartes. And so they decided to go with it. And so they helped those philosophies become commonplace, right? It was the approval of the establishment and the elite and the wealthy people who basically allowed this philosophy to blossom. If they hadn't liked it, they wouldn't have let that happen, and they certainly wouldn't have called it the Enlightenment, right? They would have called it something that would have made it unpopular, right? So it's a kind of a PR game was being played.
Right? Even back then. Oh, my goodness.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, establishments generate a vocabulary that validates what they do, right?
Mm-hmm.
So everything that they like gets called good names. You know, when somebody writes the Oxford English Dictionary or whatever, a word comes into usage by the media, that word always, you know, if the establishment has anything to say about it, which it normally does, then things that the establishment likes get positive words. You know, they don't like GMOs being called frankenfoods. They want them to be called genetic engineering, which is a frankenfood may be a little bit of a misdescription of genetic engineering, but genetic engineering is not a good description of what people actually do when they engineer plants. You know, they basically fire in pieces of the DNA on a particle that then randomly breaks up, randomly inserts, and randomly causes all kinds of trouble. That is not engineering, right? But that's the establishment vocabulary word. You know, that's what you're expected to call it. If you write a scientific paper, that's what you're expected to call it in the media. So it's always been the case that the establishment controls the vocabulary. So, you know, whenever you hear a word, like enlightenment, it should raise a red flag as to whether it really is so enlightened or so wonderful.
You know, we're deviating from our topic here, but I am, a little bit, but you know, we do have the full hour. I'm fascinated by what you're saying, because one of the things, and I just can't resist, since you think in these kinds of terms, to ask you, a further question about that, because, you know, one of the things that I've been noticing as a journalist and someone who's active with groups and active on social media and, you know, and in the blogosphere and the the field of the news and all of that, is that it appears in the present time that there almost has been a fragmentation among the population of people, and I don't want to include the total population. I'm talking about, let's just confine the discussion to the sort of liberal, progressive, or what would sort of fly under that wing or thinks it's under that wing, and even those terms are very much up for grabs right now. You know, in that population, we're seeing a fragmentation. The fragmentation, and so people who were friends and allies who all thought they shared common cause, agreed on a range of issues, have been sharply differing and even fighting, you know, rather aggressively with each other in the current election. Obviously, you know, the role of the various candidates, who they are, what they represent, how people perceive them or misperceive them, all of that is a big part of the story, as is the media that people access and consume, because if one is in a conventional mainstream media outlet and has long, it's become habitual and ingrained to believe in the words put forth, the names, the naming, the kind of information or orientation to information, which is what you're bringing up, that is present in those outlets, versus, you know, other outlets with different interpretations. So actually, there has been I've been perceiving this and kind of scratching my head and going, how can we talk about this and get our minds around this? There's actually a split in what used to be among, you know, the liberal progressive group, a somewhat more uniform consensus. And so, and there are some people who are still, but this is the consensus. This is what everyone thinks, and therefore I must think it. And there are other people who, in fact, have more of the skeptical, critical approach to that, disillusioned, kind of approach to that due to various things that you're describing, where, you know, these are phrases that are put out there, these are beliefs that are put out there, I don't buy them. And then so there are then other scripts, other beliefs, other descriptions of what is going on in our reality. And so people formerly allied are conflicting because of, you know, the fact that a substantive number of people, and here I would include everyone, not just liberals and progressives, a substantive number of people have, have kind of gone off the ranch and have departed from the consensus that was supposed to be operative. And in effect, there are many things going on in the current election, but one of the things that's very central to it is, do we, you know, can we still vest in, stay with, and modify that consensus, or, you know, how do we depart constructively from that consensus? And, you know, and so there's a lot of fear and loathing around all of that. You know, it strikes me that you, as a scientist, and I guess a bit of an analyst and historical analyst and philosopher, may have some interesting perspective and orientation for people on that question.
I mean, what you ask is a very important question, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, my take on it would be that, you know, historically, the establishment essentially controlled the narrative around which we discussed just about every issue. And, you know, in countries like the U.S. and countries like Britain, there was historically a, you know, there would be a left-wing party and a right-wing party, and they would basically corral opinions around, you know, some fairly small number of media outlets. And so basically the vocabulary, the sort of accepted range of opinions would be restricted to, you know, half a dozen media outlets and a small and those two political parties, and no one essentially else had a voice, right? You know, there were a very small number of other people publishing minority pieces. You know, you might have Socialist Worker magazine or something like that, but basically, you know, 99.9% of the population was exposed to the same media and the same that small set of opinions. And you know, what's happened on the, especially on the left, is that that's all broken open with the advent of the internet. You know, people no longer, there's no one really, the Democratic Party, for example, is no longer in control of the left-wing narrative that they were in the past. And that includes the vocabulary, but it also includes, you know, the media outlets. You know, there's all these diverse media outlets now. You know, they have an undue influence in some of those media outlets, but they certainly don't have a good control over what's going on. And so many, many more people are reading a much more diverse set of media and opinions and coming to quite radically different opinions. But what that means is that also it's very difficult for somebody who's even now outside of, you know, the Democratic Party base or the Republican Party base to actually formulate a coherent set of opposition, a sort of set of policies that makes sense. It makes it very, very difficult for someone else to sort of come up with a set of policies that any group, any decent sized group of people can coalesce around. You know, what's been, you know, what was organized by the Labour Party, you know, basically the Labour Party in Britain, for example, had quite strict party discipline about, you know, we're going to support nuclear power or we're not. We're going to support, you know, an ethical foreign policy or we're not. You know, and basically, you know, you had to coalesce around the leader or else form your own set of philosophies that might, or set of policies that might possibly confront those at a certain point, but that was essentially controlled from by a small number of people, and that situation has totally evaporated. And Fox News does the same thing in many ways to the on the right side of the political spectrum, and you know, they may not manage to do that for the foreseeable future either. But so I think that would be my take on your opinion. And so what's interesting to me about, to bring it back to the food movement, is that the food movement actually offers a coherent alternative that no one else, in my opinion, is really offering at the moment to the status quo.
And what is that narrative? I mean, you know, what is different about it? What is the narrative around it? How does that help create an option or options? You know, for intervention in what is clearly a very, you know, dangerous, high-risk kind of situation.
We are in an unstable situation right now. Yeah, I totally agree. And there are many characteristics to the food movement. I mean, the article I wrote is quite long, but actually there are many more things that I could have put in there that were characteristics of the food movement. But what I focused on really was how the food movement uses biological thinking to formulate its opinions. Right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, many people in the food movement have their personal experience of, you know, a health issue or of farming or of growing vegetables, and they use the experiences to drive their understanding of bigger issues in many cases. So people have experience of how, for example, the natural world is full of synergism, right? So we have, you know, the historical narrative which came to us through the Enlightenment. Let's go back to that for a start. is that organisms are not connected to each other, for example. And even within organisms, our brain is not connected to our body, for example. You know, the Enlightenment made all these assumptions about how people were. And, you know, they called us clockwork robots. Things like, you know, people use these phraseologies to try to help people understand. And this mindset still exists today. You know, Richard Dawkins and his social Darwinism type ideology called people lumbering robots. You know, this is exactly the same language as the Enlightenment. But people, you know, people understand perfectly well themselves that they're not robots. But that's not the establishment view. You know, when he published that book, he was promoted to being professor of public understanding of science, even though he perpetrated the most outrageous piece of misunderstanding you could possibly imagine by calling people robots, right? That was the sort of thesis of his book. And so basically, you know, you can see on the one hand how the establishment is promoting ideas that it likes. You know, some nobody scientist comes along and publishes a book and calls everybody robots. All of a sudden they become professor at Oxford. So they're promoting these ideas. But the food movement has a completely different set of ideas, right? The food movement's ideas is that biological organisms, biological reality is based on synergism, right? Let me give you an example. And, you know, the beginning of life, there was probably one organism, right? Or a very, very small number of organisms. And over the 4.5 billion years through which life has been evolving on our planet, it's now that number of species has gone to, you know, countless billions, tens of millions of species at the very least. And so what's basically happened is the existence of one species creates an opportunity for another species to evolve. And then when there's two species, that creates an opportunity for a third species. And when there's three, it creates opportunities for more, right? And so you have you see ecosystems in which the cows eat the grass, but they fertilize the grass, but the cows need the grass in order to eat. And so you just got these ecosystems that have evolved and become more complicated and more complicated over time, which is totally in opposition to the Enlightenment understanding that organisms, A, are not connected to each other, and B, confront each other and compete with each other and try to rip each other to shreds, right? So they had this idea, you know, which Richard Dawkins did his best to encourage. And you know, I was given this for his book to read. It was the only book I was given as an undergraduate to read, was this, his Selfish Gene book, right? So they had this, you know, he basically, you know, came up with the most reductionistic formulation of this concept, which is basically that genes compete with it. Not only individuals and groups compete with each other, but genes compete with each other. And, you know, the establishment loved this, but unfortunately, the data, if you want to interpret the data in any kind of generalistic and big picture terms, the data doesn't support the Dawkins type competition interpretation. Because at the end of the day, in order to have competition, you have to have first two organisms to compete with each other, right? So the prior fact is the existence of life forms that are cooperative and synergistic, and only at that point can you then have competition, right? So the Enlightenment idea, the whole Enlightenment idea of animals competing with each other is basically is based on a misinterpretation of biology, okay? And if you have, if your whole society is based on the misinterpretation of biology, and biological reality is the most important reality that you're aware of, because you're a biological organism, and you know almost all your interactions are some in one way or another biological, then you have to live in cohesion, in what would be the right word? And you basically, your philosophy should reflect the underlying reality. And we've had a philosophy for the last 400 years that basically denied the underlying reality. And that's why we're in this ecological crisis. That's why we're in this social crisis, right? Because we're denying the biological reality of what's going on around us, and in the process destroying everything.
Right? Wow.
And so the food movement...
Before we go to the food movement, before we go back to the food movement, because you're actually a brilliant explicator and interpreter of, core scientific understandings that are so widely misunderstood, that I'm just so grateful that to hear your thought, share it with listeners, and engage with you about this. I just want to spell this out one step further. So, and just make it like almost to a cartoon level, if I may, and make sure if I get this right, okay? So you can, kind of adjust it. So what you're saying is that, in effect, the Enlightenment interpretation of science as purveyed by Dawkins and others, actually, it's used foundationally as our entire understanding of science in the way we study stuff and how we talk about it. It's like we're breaking it down. So in effect, it's like we took a snapshot of two animals. Let's say they're two bears, and they are competing and fighting with each other, right? And we said, this is the law of nature, right? But we're ignoring the fact that these are highly evolved mammals that, throughout all of evolution, they came up from out of the sea, they cooperated, they ate plants, they ate the bugs that, would undermine the plants that other animals needed. So there's this whole web of cooperation and interconnection going on until you even get the evolution of a mammal, no less a bear. And all of that had to happen to feed and create this whole web of life that we're living with. And yet all we're claiming is the operative science that we need to focus on is the two bears when they fight with each other. And that retroactively is declared the ruling force of nature. Is that pretty much what you're...
That's exactly right.
And one of the reasons we're doing this is that we're egocentric or anthropocentric or whatever that word would be. In other words, we think that we want to apply everything to ourselves. We think that, mankind rules. So, people would resonate with an experience of competition if they were in an economically competitive situation, if they ever felt fear for survival or deprivation or anything else. This would, immediately the notion that I have to struggle and with someone else to obtain sustenance might resonate to human experience, and so therefore that becomes sticky as an interpretation because humans resonate with it from where they are, from their own experience, even though from a scientific perspective, and of course it is the job of science to have a broader and more accurate view than what we could emotionally discern. That's its one, or subjectively discern. That's its one great benefit. Not that there's anything wrong with humans having subjective responses, but the role of science is really not to just run with that only. The role of science is to correct that. And here, what you're describing is science is perpetrating this very destructive, narrow, and inaccurate interpretation.
I mean, they're perpetrating an ideology on the population because it rose, this whole idea rose up during the Victorian era, when people were moving from feudalism to this idea that, you live in a town instead of living in a village where you cooperate with the people around you and you help each other out with the harvest and everything, that The establishment wanted people to move to the cities. They wanted people to have individual jobs. They wanted people basically to be socially mobile. So that also chimed with the whole idea of evolution and the idea of basically if you're going to have competition, then somebody comes out as a winner and somebody comes out as a loser. And so the winner moves up and the loser moves down. All this kind of social mobility thinking chimed with what the establishment wanted. And so they strongly supported all this kind of neo-Darwinist type interpretation of existence, which essentially, ignores the presumptions that I pointed out earlier. And your description of it is totally accurate.
Okay, great. Now tell us then how the food movement functions as a natural corrective to that and to that experience.
Well, I mean, in practice, what happens is, our own experiences of life, right, as family members or as people who go shopping or as people who go who participate in all kinds of activities, we don't spend too much of our time actually competing with each other, right? When I go shopping, I am cooperating with the people in the store. If I go to the farmers market, I'm cooperating with them to get the job done. You know, somebody's providing me with vegetables and I'm going to buy them. Or, I'm in a family and, maybe my partner will cook one day and I'll cook the other day or whatever. This competition idea is not people's daily experience of life, right? That's not what happens. There are occasional times when you compete with somebody, but you could go weeks without competing or years without competing. So if you stay in the same job for the rest of your life, you work in a company which is a cooperative institution, right? And so this whole competition idea is not experienced by most people most of the time. It's an idea that they have in their heads that is, in a sense, enforced by the media. It's one of those narratives that I was referring to that people are, essentially have put on them by other people, right? I was given this book when I was an undergraduate and told to read it and internalize it, and I saw it as an explanation of various things, and which it is. It's not the competition never happens. That's not the case. It's just the question of what is the prior fact. So what the food movement is basically doing is it's looking at people's daily experiences and saying, I can solve my problems better by thinking about them as problems that require cooperation as a solution than things that require competition as a solution. And so people are using that daily experience and basically refuting what they've been told or taught or whatever it is and using those to solve their problems. So, for example, they'll use food waste to make compost to grow plants and those plants are then, returned to the soil or whatever. That is a cooperative experience. Or you have famous members of the food movement like Joel Salatin, for example. I don't know if you've interviewed him or know about his farm. He's using animals to cooperate with each other on his farm. Right? The Enlightenment ideology of farming is that nothing is connected to anything else, that you have animals on one farm and you have vegetables on another farm or corn on another farm, and then somebody buys corn from one farm to feed the animals on another farm. Everything is disconnected from each other, whereas what the food movement is discovering is that if you incorporate that kind of thinking into your farming, not only do you have better farming, but you can also make money, right? So you can have grass-fed beef makes more money than a CAFO does, right? Which requires a CAFO is a huge operation that requires fossil fuels. It requires corn to be grown, even on another continent and brought to that facility and then fed to the animals. And then somehow you've got to get rid of the waste from all those animals. And so basically, CAFOs are things that require subsidies to operate. But the food movement is discovering that, you can grow, you can have cows and keep them on the same piece of grass or rotate them around your field and actually make money in that process. Because you're employing biological thinking along the lines of what I suggested about synergies and cooperation to actually organize your thinking about how you do your farming, how you do your food system, how you do your feeding people, how you organize to help each other. And so the food movement is basically, you know, through using synergisms and cooperation, is being more successful than, you know, Monsanto or the USDA or Walmart or industrial agriculture in the general mm-hmm. sense. And so you're using this thinking to not only make money but to gain power in the real world, right? And so mm-hmm. so people are you know, finding that the experience of freeing themselves from enlightenment restrictions on what they should do and ought to do are actually working for them. And so that's why mm-hmm. the food movement is growing and being successful.
Yeah, that's so interesting. I personally belong, my family belongs to a food co-op in an urban environment. It's one of the oldest ones in the United States. It's fairly large. And it's really a model of what could be done with cooperation. Because, for example, this is one of my favorite examples, but because of the fact that we have such a population, everyone works for credit rather than just contributing money. You know, in other words, there's mm-hmm. labor and working together mm-hmm. involved in various roles and interaction with other people. As a result, you know, because there is, you know, 15,000 people, there's an ability to cooperate with local farms to get mm-hmm. a wider mm-hmm. diversity of produce than would otherwise be obtainable in terms of, you know, many different kinds of apples, lamb's quarters in the spring, you know, things that you wouldn't necessarily mm-hmm. easily mm-hmm. find elsewhere. And in fact, they even came along and one of our regular farmer suppliers developed minimally treated bitter melon. And bitter melon is a traditional I'm a health and food reporter, right? So it's a traditionally anti-diabetic food, in both the Chinese and Indian cultures. It has a bitter taste, and it actually, you know, helps to restore and repair the insulin system, which is so damaged in Americans by our need, you know, and consumption of intense sweets, you know, compensating for the difficulties of our society. We're like eating all these sweets, you know, to make ourselves feel better, make something sweet out of it. But eating these bitter foods is a corrective, and in fact, they naturally grow in the fall season where because they're kind of like a squash or a zucchini in terms of, you know, what they're similar to in physically, biologically. And it comes in after the summer fruit so that we kind of eat the summer fruit. We get all the antioxidants, and then nature then in this, you know, four climate cycle that we have supplies these, you know. And so now they're growing ones that have not been treated with pesticides or chemicals or anything. And every time I go to the co-op, I stock up. Because I eat them quite regularly. And every time I go, I get, I don't know, a minimum of 3 to 5 people, you know, the people checking me out, the people who see it in the cart, asking how to cook them. So I'm constantly giving out cooking instructions.
So even
in an urban environment,
yeah.
the food and cooperation kind of intrinsically go together in a certain kind of way. So that's, you know, what about these horrible trade deals? I cover them, you know, regularly on the Connect the Dots program, have since 2014, have had a whole bunch of experts. We're kind of coming down the line to a potential vote in the lame duck session of Congress directly following the election. President Obama is pushing them hard. They would remove labeling from food, push exports. They could, through various provisions, work against local food because, for example, if a school system decides, makes a policy decision in that community to purchase local foods for the children and thereby support local farming, that could be through the letting down of all these trade rules, that could set up a situation where a farmer or a food supplier in another part of the world could say, you're disadvantaging my food product by your
mm-hmm.
activities, and I'm going to sue
mm-hmm.
you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the coming European deal, the TTIP, is seen as potentially even more harmful to food. But what do you see as the concerns there, and how do people balance local grassroots action and organizing with preventing, you know, these kinds of overrule laws that would kind of prescribe to communities, local communities, what we can and cannot do.
I mean, my general feeling about these trade deals is they're they're basically anti-democratic, right? They
mm-hmm.
they will basically undermine democratic legal agreements that people have reached often a great effort over decades. They will undermine all of that. So they're fundamentally problematic from that point of view. You're basically selling away your government in many respects by agreeing to these rules. And specifically to the food movement, it does represent a threat. If policies, for example, the European Union doesn't allow government to promote local food, right? So it doesn't. One of the ideas of the free market was that there's equal access to all the different localities to people from every part of the continent, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the British government might want to introduce a campaign to eat local food or British food or something like that, but they're not allowed to under the rules of the European Union. And if they spend money on advertising or something like that, they will be fined. So there are threats to localization that arise from these things. At the same time, for the most part, governments are not very interested in localization. And so, they're not really pushing in the way they could do for positive developments in that way. But, the biggest threat, it would seem to me, I mean, I haven't read the details of these agreements, but it would seem to me pretty obvious that if you restrict the labeling that's allowed, for example, of the country of origin or the contents or any of many aspects of the labeling of food that consumers want to know about what they're eating, if you restrict that information, then people can't make good choices and they can't organize around making those good choices, and so it will hamper the food movement. It may, I don't think it will sink the food movement by any means, but it will certainly make things a little bit more difficult. But it will also, if these trade deals really go through, it will focus people's attention on what's really important. And I think for me, what's really important is to build up the understanding of people of A, of the food movement, and B, of the general population's understanding of how much their lives are influenced by the food that they eat and the food choices that they make. And so,
mm-hmm.
I'm really supportive of people who share information about food systems and about food food growing techniques, or go to farmers markets or buy local food. And I'm really, trying to encourage people to spend their time building up the positive things of what it means to be in a food movement and the kind of alternatives that can offer, and not worry too much about policy issues and such like. But, these trade agreements are super important. It would be a horrible step backwards if any of these were adopted. But at the same time, you have to keep your eyes on the prize, right? Of what kind of society do you really want at the end of the day? And we're going to have to make very active decisions about where we spend our time. Do you try to fight against things, or do you try to build up the positive that you can see is going to work for you in 10 or 20 years' time? And certainly.
Okay, I'm gonna challenge you on that. Sorry, I have to challenge that because
yeah,
I think you need to really do both. Because otherwise, what you wind up with is a group of privileged rural dwellers, you know, and then the Dark Act comes and overwhelms what they're trying to do. And so,
mm-hmm.
you know, unless you do both, I think it's more human scaled, and more people would prefer to, you know, retreat to a safe place and you know, kind of just tend to their own garden, so to speak. I think that's, you know, that's more in keeping with our history and our comfort zone and how we're biologically wired. You know, there's no doubt about that. But at the same time, if we have these larger scale systems that are working together, planning, conglomerating, and running rampant in ways that are going to severely restrict our freedoms, then I think we have to do both. And on the other hand, also, you know, the whole, you know, notion of rural food supply and farming and all of that, you know, it kind of leaves out a lot of folks who are disadvantaged, who, you know, in inner cities, many people have never laid eyes on a vegetable apart from like a ketchup packet or something like that, because of and it's an, you know, it's a food justice issue, and also what will happen is, you know, it's the same thing that will happen in the healthcare system. The privileged people go off in their corner and take care of themselves, and then everyone else is you know, is left with a mess. So I think, again, because we're all connected for the very reasons you mentioned, we you know, we have the challenge of doing both and thinking both local scale, in, you know, national scale and global scale. You know, that would
Yeah, I'm glad you raised that issue, you know, because because the way I see it is that, you know, of course there are, you know, the elite people, you know, including, for example, people like the Chinese leaders, right, who fly in their organic food from Tibet because, you know, the normal agricultural system is, you know, contaminated with, you know, endless numbers of toxic chemicals and so forth. And there are those people who, you know, see the food system in a certain way as a place to get expensive organic food from Trader Joe's or whatever it is, and or to, you know, to fence themselves off from the rest of the world, if you like. You know, I can buy organic food. But there's also, you know, loads and loads of people out there who are not nearly so wealthy. You know, some of them very impoverished, who are also benefiting from the food movement, you know, and the food movement that they're benefiting from is pretty different from that, you know, organic, expensive, elite version of the food movement. But it's people, for example, doing urban farming, for example, or there are people, you know, people in Detroit reclaiming plots to grow vegetables for themselves, right? The food movement, one of the great things about the food movement is that it can work for just about anyone. You know, and if you have, for example, you know, you can reclaim, you know, your community and your power through, you know, growing vegetables, through gardening, through allotments, through community schemes. You know, that kind of system can work. It can be very inexpensive and can really work for people who have very little, right? And people who are discriminated against, for example. And it can, but it also, you know, it's also nice because it can work on a ethnic and cultural level. You know, if you come from Vietnam, or you're a refugee from Syria, you know, one of the few things that you can do is come to another country and start gardening and growing food for your family, right? That's something that really, that people are doing. You know, it's totally a reality. And so, you know, when I talk about the food movement, you know, there is an interpretation of it that is, you know, that is quite, you know, in some sense is not grounded, you know, depending on outside income coming from other places and so forth. But there's also the whole reality of it, which is, you know, things like peasant uprisings in Brazil and peasant uprisings in Mexico and such like, you know, where basically people who have very little are using the food movement and the tools of food and the tools of food information to empower themselves. And so, you know, I do want to emphasize that part of it, you know, is that this is the movement. One of the great things that characterizes the food movement is it's pretty, it's almost universal in the kinds of people that it can incorporate and benefit. You know, mm-hmm. all of us can learn from it, and all of us can benefit from it. And I think that's a mm-hmm. super important thing. And occasionally, you know, Prince Charles gets together with people from minority communities. And I know that doesn't happen very often, but at the mm-hmm. same time, his people like him are, you know, in doing things that are not so very different from what people are doing in Detroit or Cleveland or somewhere like that. So we should, mm-hmm. it's hard not to misrepresent the food movement, you know, because it's mm-hmm. so broad and so complicated, and we all live in different places. You know, we all see it in different ways. And, you mm-hmm. know, I live in Ithaca, you know, where a lot of it is around the farmer's market, which is really quite expensive. And, mm-hmm. but there are lots of other people doing stuff outside of that farmer's market who will sell mm-hmm. us vegetables at a third of the price that you can get them at the farmer's market. And those kinds mm-hmm. of people can, you know, are selling them less at the lower price than Walmart, for example. You know, mm-hmm. there's a great example that I heard recently. So some people decided they wanted to get fresh fish, and they wanted to fairly trade it with people who were basically operating boats in Alaska. And these people mm-hmm. lived in Wisconsin, right, which is 5,000 miles from Alaska, where they wanted to get their fish mm-hmm. from. Because, they came across these people just fortuitously, bought some fish on the dock, and then they figured out a system by which they could run a sort of fish CSA. And the mm-hmm. fish CSA would basically involve them, you know, FedExing fish straight off the boat to Chicago airport, and then they would pick up the fish, and they would drive mm-hmm. it to people's homes who wanted to buy it. And they could basically do it cheaper than the local stores. Okay? Mm-hmm. So the local, mm-hmm. what that's telling you is something really interesting about those local stores, that they're creaming off a huge amount of money off the food supply chain, that they can't mm-hmm. do it cheaper than somebody who just spends a week setting it up with, off their own bats, basically. And so mm-hmm. so you have, you know, an incredibly diverse system that is also open to change. You know, all sorts mm-hmm. of opportunities exist for people who want to take advantage of them.
Mm. And I just saw something that the salmon, for example, you know, are slowing down in droves because of the whole environmental situation. So, mm-hmm. you know, again, it's like... you know, you have the entrepreneurship and, you know, the trying to kind of make stuff available and do a workaround, but it also, then the kind of has the final word and all of that in its own way in any case.
Well, the major threat mm-hmm. to farm salmon, so the major mm-hmm. threat to salmon are, you know, the depletion of waterways and human activities around waterways, which have to do with agriculture, right? And mm-hmm. and for the most part, but also the escape of fish from mm-hmm. factory farms, from basically farmed salmon. So the farmed salmon have genetic characteristics that are being then transferred into the population and making a monoculture population out in the wild because mm-hmm. they're escaping in such large numbers. But also they are basically disease factories, these farmed fish. So they're like... Mm-hmm. and unpleasant organisms that flourish when animals are kept in too much proximity are ending mm-hmm. up being threatening the local populations. So,
terrible.
What's interesting, mm-hmm. yeah, no, it's really not good. And mm-hmm. so, you know, the threat to those, you know, this is what's so interesting about the food movement too, is that, you know, our civilization is built around agriculture. That's still the case. Mm-hmm. And our threats to the environment are mostly built around agriculture, too. You know, if you mm-hmm. could have a food system that didn't use toxic chemicals, that didn't overproduce all the time, that was respectful of the land, that didn't cause soil erosion, for example, you would also have a food system that didn't destroy coral reefs, that didn't cause dead zones, that didn't cause people to become unhealthy, that didn't cause all kinds of pollution to rivers and lakes, You basically, you know, almost every environmental threat that exists to birds and bees and bats and pollinators and so forth, they almost all originate from the food system, right? So our task, in a sense, is to understand how important the food system is to our ecological stability and integrity. You know, a huge amount, for example, of the carbon dioxide that goes into the atmosphere originates with the food system. You know, a huge proportion of the trucks that are on the road.
Is that from animals, or what's your view on the animal situation,
all,
even though we only have another
place,
3 minutes? Oh, it's not only the animals.
Yeah, it's from all over the place. Right? It's from, you know, fertilizer production. Until recently, something like 3% of all carbon dioxide emissions came from the manufacture of artificial fertilizers. But also you have the manufacture of pesticides is a huge consumer of carbon dioxide, producer of carbon dioxide. The emissions of carbon from the soil. When you plow soils, you put fertilizers on them, you create huge amounts of carbon dioxide pollution. And so the food system is, you know, is the single biggest cause of climate change out of all the climate causes that we know of. Right, you know, all those oil refineries, all those chemical companies, they exist basically to serve the food system, right? To create pesticides, to create tractor fuel, to create tractors, to they're contributing so much to the carbon dioxide production that if we solve the problems of agriculture, we would solve so many of our problems. You know, the birds would come back, the bees would come back, the bats would come back. You know, so people mischaracterize our environmental footprint, and they imagine it's, you know, things like plastic bags or whatever, which, you know, in part it is, but so much of it originates in the food system that we have so many opportunities to synergistically remove those causes of pollution. So that's one of my big messages to people is, you know, understand how much of that all originates with the food system. And the food system is such an important thing, problem to solve.
Wow, that's really powerful. Fascinating. We could do a whole show on that. Well, we're coming into our last minute on the program, so I just want to take this, you know, opportunity to thank you, Jonathan Latham. This has just been an absolutely awesome and, you know, terrific opportunity to, you know, get your full view on all of this fascinating stuff. You really have thought so much of it through so incredibly thoroughly. And I also really appreciate and enjoyed our, you know, kind of diversion into, you know, the overriding scientific context for so many of our beliefs and so much of the misinformation. Listeners, you can read Jonathan's current article, Why the Food Movement is Unstoppable, as well as his previous work and his future work, by going to independentsciencenews.org, which is the website of science information he edits with a special focus on the food system. Thank you so much for being with us today on Connect the Dots, Jonathan. Really enjoyed having you on and the whole conversation and all your wisdom on all these topics.
Well, thank you, Alison. And if you want to have another interview about the impacts of the food system, that would be a very constructive thing, I think.
I think so too, and we're going to do it. I want to hear more about this, and I'm sure our listeners do too. So we'll have Jonathan back on again. Meanwhile, read his terrific current article on Independent Science News. Thank you, listeners, for being with us this week on Connect the Dots. Come back next Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time. I'm Alison Rose Levy. Be well.